Hey guys, I just want to start off by saying thank you for listening to the podcast. But I can't stress enough how important it is for me to continue on producing content, for you to go on and leave us a review on iTunes or the Podbean app. Your questions and comments help me keep this thing going, and It's really important for the podcast. The more reviews we get and the higher up in the ranking I go, the more people I could reach. It's really important for you to do so. If you really like the podcast, we'd like to hear from you. And we would really, really appreciate the feedback and reviews. Also want to take a little bit of time here real quick to thank Phoenix Shooting Bags for their continued support of the podcast. And if you want to up your shooting game, go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. You can use promo code John Stallone, all one word, and purchase bags for 20% off. So check them out. This, honestly, it's a game changer, and you won't be disappointed. So phoenixshootingbags.com. Let's roll into the next episode. Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masses, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. This week, we're going to talk a little bit about hunting elk in Idaho. Got a buddy of mine, Daryl Ponch Nunez, on. And it's kind of a funny story. Daryl and I met coos deer hunting here in Arizona, or deer hunting, rather, not necessarily coos deer, although we were after coos deer. I just happened to... I'd be sitting in my glassing spot, and I heard a truck come up the other side, and I'm like, I'm gonna go see who that is, and it ended up being Daryl. We kind of became friends. We found that we had some mutual friends, one of which is Perry Kremens, and the relationship blossomed from there. How's it going?
Good, man. Appreciate you having me on here. And yeah, that was kind of ironic how we had mutual friends, and especially Perry. I mean, you were just telling me how you're going to get to go. You're going to finally get to go hunting on for yourself. And
yep.
you never mentioned a name or anything. Of course, we never thought that would be the case. And then next thing you know, he calls me up and says, "Yeah, I just went hunting with John Stallone." I'm like, "Oh, okay." Yeah, so. Yeah, that was kind of cool. And I ended up selling my 15 by 56 to one of your clients.
yes. Yep. He's enjoying them. He actually, I just sent him a marsupial bino harness for those like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Boy, those are great. I love that bino harness.
Yeah. No, me too. I've pretty good close relationship with the owner, Jim, and you know, so I'm always giving them feedback on it and whatnot. And their latest version is like super comfortable. They've gotten rid of all the like little squeaky stuff that was going on that was bothering me. But yeah, so it's a good product. Really good product.
Yeah. I actually just got the new one, here probably about a month ago. I don't know if it's the latest and greatest one, but, last year, I was on a hog hunt in the springtime, and my current bino system that I had wouldn't fit my new binoculars I got. So okay. I borrowed, and it happened to be a marsupial that I borrowed from my buddy that owns Advantage Archery in Twin Falls, Idaho. And so I took them on this pig hunt, and I thought, man, these are pretty cool. I really like these. So I went ahead and used those other ones, but again, I switched and got a pair of 12 by 50 Swarovskis this year, and just a couple months ago. So I went ahead and just bought those marsupials because I knew that I really liked them. I really like them. So,
yeah. They're hard to beat. They really are. So real quick before we roll into the questions I got for you, give me a little rundown about yourself. So those people who don't know you, what you do.
Okay. So I live in Idaho, and I've been there since like 1983, and I grew up in a real small town, you know, like way less than 10,000 in San Joaquin Valley in Central California. I loved to hunt and fish, and it was available, you know, hog hunting and blacktail hunting and good fishing, and but the mountains just weren't quite close enough for me. So first opportunity that I had to get out of there, I went ahead and left. And Idaho just happened to be where that opportunity came about. I wasn't picky to the point, you know, I'd have went to Montana or Oregon or Utah or just somewhere where I can, where I wanted to hunt elk and, you know, and just have an antelope on a regular basis if I could. So that's kind of how I ended up there. Didn't get to hunt elk until 84 was the first year. Had no clue what I was doing. And finally got to meet up with some guys through an archery club on that kind of helped me out a little bit. And it wasn't until 87 that I actually did kill my first bull. And I've been hooked since, you know, and I'm just a regular Joe. I tell people whenever I do get a chance to do a seminar or something that I have not done anything no one else can't do. A lot of times I just, and a good portion of my stuff has, my success has been, or unsuccess too, is trial and error. And I think that's some of the best things. Too many people, I think, a lot of times go out and just, if they don't get success the first year or two, they get pretty disappointed. And it's like some of my best years, the times where I really learned the most about elk were the years that I failed the most, or, right. You know, or probably I remember one year in particular that, I told myself I'd killed just a few bulls, and I told myself, I hope I'm not getting ahead of myself too much here, but, I just kind of told myself I'm going to hold out, try to kill a 6-point because I hadn't killed one yet. Mm-hmm. And that year I ended up having, I was shooting a recurve at the time. So I had 11 opportunities with a recurve, which are, you know, real close distances. Wow. And I didn't kill one. I couldn't buy 6-point, but I had nearly everything else come in within range. But I learned so much about elk that year. So that was kind of a turning point for me. Cool. Career wise, I was a meat cutter for nearly 20 years, which always kind of helped me when I'm in the field. Mm-hmm. And then, I've done some construction, and about the last 10 or more years, I've been, working for a mining contractor, primarily up in Alaska. And my primary job has been handling explosives. Wow. So I'm one of the few guys that can really say my job was a blast. So, but yeah, that's been a good career, and I'm actually looking to change something a little bit different here now that, you know, I'll be 56 here in less than a month, and, you know, pushing your body pretty hard all those years. I just think, you know, I still want to be able to get around good, and the harder I am on my body, the, you know, less time I'm going to have to chase my kids around and enjoy the mountains. So I've kind of decided to make a career change and do something where I can make money with my brain instead of just working my physically, you know, body. So that's kind of what I'm after now.
Smart. I did the same thing myself. Yeah, it's probably 12 plus years now where I really tried to stay out of the field, working, in my pool construction company. I used to do a lot of the repairs, a lot of all that crap. I used to do that stuff myself. I mean, it's important for the owner to know how to do everything himself.
Sure.
You know, one, if I have to step in, two, so I know what to tell people what to do. But, yeah, I don't want to do backbreaking work anymore. That's why, you know, that's what I got young guys to do. So,
yeah, I see a lot of younger kids, especially they push themselves hard. And, you know, I always try to tell them when I can. A lot of times they don't want to listen, but, you know, just watch it, watch your body, how you treat your body now, because you'll end up, paying for it later. And, when I did guide for quite a few years, and, one thing I remember, there was a couple guides there that, were former, pro rodeo guys. Mm-hmm. And they're in their 20s then at the time, and getting up and just eating the ibuprofen, like, you know, for breakfast because they were hurting so bad. And so, yeah, I guess with age, I've realized, you know, kind of try to work a little smarter instead of harder.
Yeah. One of my really good friends and guy that I used to work for, Billy Babish of Let It Rip Outfitters, he was a big rodeo guy. The guy's got like pins in his legs and yeah. He walked. He has to push the screw back in from the outside.
Oh,
like,
oh man.
Crazy shit like that. Like he's, but he goes, man, he goes and goes.
Oh yeah, dude, man. Those guys that I worked with are just that you don't get them any tougher. And, they're funny to work with, man. I had some really good times there. So, yeah.
Well, cool. So I got a bunch of questions for you related to elk hunting in Idaho specifically.
Okay.
You know, if a guy's planning a trip out to Idaho, let's talk about logistics and like what can somebody expect, you know, what's the tag situation like? Let's just paint the whole picture of what it is if I wanted to go on a hunt in Idaho, and okay. Like, let's talk the different seasons and whatnot too.
So yeah, in fact, I've got a friend that's from Arizona that is wanting to put in this year, and my suggestion is, you know, Idaho has a lot of great over the counter type, especially for archery, that. You can just buy a tag. Some areas are, you know, I believe it's broken up into like 28 zones, if I remember right. And it used to be when I first started, there was basically three tags in Idaho. You had the panhandle tag, you had the mountain tag, and then you had the regular tag. And at that time, you know, I was hunting kind of the central part of the state, and then I'd run over to southeastern corner and hunt there for a few days, and I'd run back up and hunt the other place because I could, you know, the tag. And then they broke it up into zones. Can't remember exactly what year they did, but so it kind of changed the game a little bit. And I kind of opted to stay a little bit closer to where I lived. But, there, you know, Idaho is, you know, I know people say a lot of times on social media, there's no elk here at all. There's, you know, too many wolves, which I agree with the wolf thing, but there's a fair amount of elk still around. And, you know, it is pretty pretty good thing for out-of-staters as far as over-the-counter opportunity goes. My suggestion is, you know, is to – there are a handful of premium tags that are draw. And a good friend of mine last year, you know, and he actually does live in California. I still do enjoy to come back to California, incidentally, every year and go turkey and pig hunting and visit some friends. And this one particular friend of mine, he was going through some challenges with cancer. So I told him, I says, come on out and do, I was trying to give him a kind of something for him to look forward to, you know, and to keep his spirits up. So I says, come on out for antelope for archery, which was kind of a bucket list thing for him. And I says, you know, it's a guaranteed tag. It's an unlimited draw. So he's guaranteed to get a tag, but you still have to put in for it still. Well, since he was buying a – go ahead.
No, sorry. I was like, I didn't realize that you guys had an unlimited draw on those.
Yeah, there is some areas that are, yeah, for antelope. So I told him, I said, since you're going to do that and you got a hunting license, let's just go ahead and put you in for some, you know, tough to draw deer and elk tags too. And – so I put him in for a couple deer tags and a couple elk tags, and the elk tags I put him in were both for archery draws, and I'll be damned if he didn't draw one of there was 25 tags, so there was only two non-resident tags, and he drew one of them. Wow. So yeah, so you know, he's 65 years old, and like I said, just going through, I mean, poor guy, he's still had a tube coming out of his stomach because he had throat cancer. So, you know, I was looking at areas also that the terrain would work well with his ability, as mm-hmm. well as mine, because I did have a knee that kind of blew out last May, about a year ago. Excuse me. And so it still wasn't operated on yet at that time. So I was going to have to kind of watch my hunting terrain as well. And long story short, we both ended up with tags in that area. And the point of it is I would suggest, if you're going to buy a hunting license anyway, you know, put in for some of those more challenging or tougher draws. But if you do draw a tag, you're going to have one hell of a tag. If you don't, you can, get some of the over-the-counter tags that are available, which I know for non-residents, some of those areas, they have kind of a quota on them. And I know right. some of them are already sold out, but it opens somewhere in December. I'm not exactly for sure. You have to check with Fish and Game, but I believe it's one of the first part of December is when it's available. So anyway, yeah, that'd be probably one of my suggestions if that's what you're wanting to do. And, if like in John's situation, with him having his physical ability, I suggested him going with an outfitter primarily because, getting to packing out an animal. I mean, it would be challenging, you know. So even with me there, you know, with my knee and everything between his deal and my deal, where I says, yeah, it might be better off just to do like a drop camp. Or he went on a guided hunt, actually, and I kind of did. I just got packed in there basically and went hunting on my own. So it did work out good. I ended up killing for me, unfortunately, John didn't kill one, but I ended up killing a bull in the 330s, which is a good bull nice. For that area. So
nice. Yeah. That's a good bull anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I was happy. Anyway, so yeah, that'd be my suggestion. I don't know if that kind of covers your question there.
What is let me clarify some other things. So on the tag situation, you have a type tag and a B yeah. type, right?
Yep. Yeah. Sorry, I forgot about that part. The B tag, let's see. Yeah, the one tag that you get is primarily for archery. And then there is an opportunity in some of the units to hunt with a rifle for spikes, I believe. And then, you know, the other tag is primarily a rifle tag. So a lot of those areas are draws. I know there's a few over the counter. There are some over the counter for rifle as well. But archery, is primarily what I do. I'm nothing against rifle hunting at all, but I just primarily like to archery hunt. So I like the weather a lot better. Although I do enjoy some late, you know, other late hunts as well. But I kind of save my later hunts more for deer than I do elk. But okay. Yeah, so those later tags or that other tag, I should say. I know that. In fact, I know there's a couple of units this year that it's pretty much over the counter cow tag, which in their quote, there's a quota on it of like 2,500. And I'm telling you what, man, I don't know what the reasoning is behind that, but I can, maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong when I say I foresee a bad hit, you know, with the elk in the next couple of years in those units, because I don't know, when they give out that many, that's a lot of cow tags, I think. And you know, that's what reproduces our babies. So
yeah.
You know, anyway, but
yeah, you hope they're using sound science to, allocate tags, but
yeah, sometimes, when these elk and deer, they do their counts and everything. But they're up in a plane, and the animals a lot of times have reached their wintering grounds. And I just don't see how they can you know, how they really figure out exactly what's in that unit. Maybe they got it down to a science. I don't know, but
it's educated guess is what it is.
So the swag method, you ever heard that term?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder that how often that could hurt, you know, and I know they're doing their best that they can, but sometimes I kind of question things. Maybe I shouldn't. I don't know.
No, it's good to question things.
Yeah.
Like weather-wise, let's talk about that for a moment. In the early season, September season, for it starts in September or August? I can't remember.
August 30th.
Okay, August.
Yeah, August, August 30th. Most of the units. August 30th, September 30th. There are a few that change a little bit, that start a little bit later. There are some earlier elk hunts too, like you can hunt within a mile of a field starting like August 1st, I believe. And oh, wow. Yeah, and I think those are any weapon type hunts then. But
they're like a deprivation type hunt.
Yeah, yeah, you gotta. You know, I remember years ago there used to be an archery hunt, and it was within a mile of a field. And I mean, I think it was like my 1984 or something like that. Oh man, just you could, and it was in. Gosh, I want to say it was either in late July or early August. It was so dang hot out there, though. And I mean, you almost wanted to hunt by the fields because it's cooler, you know. But I never did know. You know, I had no clue what I was doing back then. So sometimes I still question it. I'm sure you think you probably agree with me on this, that every time you think you got them figured out, they educate you and humble you down. So you never go out there thinking you know it all.
That's for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, the early hunt, I know you're asking about the weather.
Yeah. What kind of weather, you know, swings could you expect?
Oh, you know, early is traditionally it's pretty warm. And I've had, you know, I've bugled in elk first, you know, the first weekend of the season, and, you know, and I've, you know, bugle them in all the way to the end, obviously, and in on into October. Even some of the rifle hunts, they're still bugling, you know, you get some of those cows that are coming in a little bit later. It's usually pretty hot, and probably the most challenging thing is just think ahead, I feel, about, okay, if it's hot, you know, where, how am I going to get it out before it's spoiling? And for many years, I've got buddies that have animals to pack out, and you know, pretty fortunate about that. But then there's years where, you know, like one year in particular, I remember I was probably, and it was the first week in September. I was up high, probably 6-7 miles from my truck by myself, and I had two bulls at 35 yards. It was 79 degrees that day. And it was going to be 81 the next day, and there's virtually no trees around. And I'm thinking, okay, let's be realistic here. If I shoot this thing, you know, it takes a little bit longer when you're by yourself. It's going to be totally exposed to the sun. And I just knew there's no way I'm going to be able to get all of it out without something spoiling. I just couldn't see it happening. And so I opted not to shoot. And I hate, you know, my theory has always been shoot it and worry about it later. But then there are times where you got to think about, that. But I told myself right then, and both of my buddies that had animals were off hunting. And so I couldn't call them. Everybody I knew was hunting, you know, that could even help off on their own. So I decided then to get animals. And I, since I've been guiding some already, you know, I guided with horses and mules, which are great. You can ride them and they work awesome. But I also hunted with llamas. And so I opted to get llamas, pack llamas, and use those. So I never had to worry about that early season hunting, about getting an animal out because of the heat. Occasionally though, you know, early in the season, you'll run into some cold weather and snow. And but for the most part, plan on it being warm. You know, always have rain. You always got to have rain gear. Anytime you're in them higher elevations, you get them showers, it seems like, which kind of cool things down a little bit. But I don't have like a preference. Like some people only go certain times of the year. The biggest reason why when I plan my hunt, typically is not so much for the rut, trying to hit the rut on the exact spot and the moon and all that, is just who's tired of elk hunting crowd wise, you know, especially when you're hunting public land. For years, I wouldn't even leave. I wouldn't even bother going until September 20th because I knew by then, pretty much everybody either killed out or they were, you know, I'd hunt during the week. I really try to stay away from the weekends, but they were pretty much killed out and, or, you know, tired of it or whatever. Wife says they can't go no more. And that's when I would plan my elk hunt quite often. There was several years there that I shot an elk the first day just because, you know, the opportunity arose and I took it.
Cool. Let's talk about planning your hunt. What are you looking for in a hunting area? Like, you know, what's your starting point before you get boots on the ground? What are some of the things you're looking for in a unit?
So I have learned a little bit more about using, you know, I'm kind of an old school guy. I guess the way I kind of learned initially was you just get out there and tromp around and try to look for sign. But, you know, I've gotten to where, you know, here again, comes back to hunting a little bit smarter and started using a little bit more Google Earth and you know, some of these new available apps and stuff on your phone that certainly can take a lot of the guesswork as far as terrain goes. But, you know, once you get into an area and start finding some relatively fresh sign. And, you know, I remember, you know, that one particular year I was telling about earlier where I learned so much, even though I didn't kill an elk that year. One thing I learned that year, and I mean, this is probably something that everybody else knew but me at that time, and was just how pattern that you're able to pattern them if they're not disturbed. Now, if they're disturbed, you know, that's one thing, pressured elk. But, you know, I was chasing this one particular herd around, basically around this huge hill. And it was a huge hill. And to be on one side in the morning, come out in the evening. And it literally took me like 2 or 3 days. And then I'm like, duh, you know, they're coming out here in the morning, then they're in the evening, then they're going around and going on the north side bedding in the morning. So that helped a bunch just with that, is looking for those. If you're planning on hunting, you know, in the morning time, a lot of times they're going to be hitting those north facing slopes where some timber is. But the areas I like to hunt a lot are kind of higher country areas. And so you don't have to necessarily rely on just them bugling. A lot of times you can see them ahead of time and do an ambush and call only when needed. I do love my bugling time, though. You know, I do love getting in there and getting a bull that's challenged, you know, willing to be challenged and willing to come in. But I've had different times where, you know, one instance in particular, I mean, I remember I got out of the truck, walked about 400 yards and a bull let a bugle out. And so I threw him everything I had and I heard feet running, thinking he's coming in, and you know what happened? He was going the other way. So I learned that one the hard way, but, end up killing the bull later on. But anyway, so getting back to the question, that's what I look for is I'm kind of looking for where I think they're going to bed, and as kind of a starting point. And especially like I said,
what is that specifically that you see on a map or you see on an aerial that says, okay, this looks like a place that elk would bed?
If it's a heavily timbered area, I'll look for benches, and water. And because that's primarily where they're going to try to end up. My experience has found they're going to try to end up where there's, you know, where there's water and shade, where it's cooler. And, you know, if you are hunting any type of deserty type areas, there's a lot of times where they are, there are still like willow type patches, or, you know, and, but I've seen them also just kind of in flats where they're sagebrush and they're just laying out, and how they do it, man, is beyond me. Those things are just tough critters. But more times than not, it's closer to water. I know, and I've heard of, elk, or seen it, literally seen elk traveling, you know, miles to go to water. And it's amazing how they're built to do that. But I've seen them do that where they literally have to travel a couple miles to water every day, back and forth. And so there again, it comes down to a pattern. You know, if I don't see no elk, my starting point is the terrain. But if I do see elk, obviously, you know, I'm observing from far away. And no, I don't bugle in middle of August just to see the reaction and educate them.
Yeah, for sure. We'll talk a little bit about behavior of elk. I know you've hunted other states for elk.
Yeah.
Now, Idaho compared to, it doesn't have to be any place. Do you feel like elk in Idaho act differently or do anything? Is there any behavioral differences that are notable and worthy of discussion?
Well, you know, like I've been down in, you know, New Mexico and Arizona and Nevada, Oregon are some of the different states I've been in, Montana. And I would say that for the most part, my experience has been, you know, that I can hunt them relatively the same as far as, you know, I look for patterns and I know a lot of people, you know, just want to hear them bugle or, you know, want to get the challenge and call them in, which like I said, is exciting and I'll do it every chance I can. But if I'm there to kill an elk or if I got a client to kill an elk, I'll do whatever it takes to kill the elk. And if that means me not making a peep, and sneaking in really close until, and then maybe do some calling, then that's what it's going to be.
Right.
And so because of that, I feel like in every state I was just talking about, you know, either I've killed elk or I've had hunters that killed elk. And it's just to me, maybe adapting a little bit to them. And, but for the most part, elk here again, you know, if they're not pressured, they're pretty patternable. They'll take the path. They'll always take the path of least resistance if they can. And so you got to, when you're looking at terrain and that type of thing, you know, you do have to consider that. And most every state you hunt in, there's going to be somewhat of a path of least resistance for them. And sometimes if they're in really rugged country, you know, that path may be rugged, but they will try to get on that path. As far as like, you know, weather does dictate, obviously, you know, in different types of weather in different, states varies. And so that can make a difference too. You know, that's, to me, that can dictate quite a bit from state to state, as far as they're moving, how much they're moving, you know, and pressure, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of, I feel maybe kind of a combination of those, and that's been my experience, you know. And here again, I don't claim to know everything, for sure. I'm always learning every year, that's for sure.
We all are.
Yeah.
What do you seem to have more success with call wise, or do you find that you go to the bugle tube a lot, or you're a cow caller, or
Well, to me, you can't beat a good cow call. You know, that'll always get a bull riled up. Too many times, you know, so I'll get back to that one story about the bull running off with his herd. And, you know, I hadn't killed but just a handful of bulls at that point. Like I said, I threw him the whole enchilada, man, everything I could think of and probably made up something. And he just turned around and beelined out of there. And as soon as I realized what happened, I'm like, duh, you know, what were you thinking? What'd you expect? Especially early in the season. A lot of times, you know, there's a good chance there might be a smaller bull that has a few cows. And I mean, they're just so excited to even have a cow. And so the last right. thing they want to do, even bigger bulls, you know, the last thing you really want to do is fight. If they can help it, man, they're going to go the other way. And that's exactly what that bull did. He took his cows and I didn't hear him again for about another hour. And he was probably close to a mile away. But all he was doing was and this is what I learned on this situation, was he was just doing a little whistle. He wasn't doing a Billy Badass bugle grunts and the whole bit. He was just doing a little whistle, just checking his herd, letting his cows know he's still in charge. And I heard him glunking a little bit. And so later on when I heard him again, I just started walking closer and getting closer, and then it got down to where he was calling, and all he was doing here again, just whistling about every 10 minutes, finally to the point where I got into, I'm creeping in. He's less than 100 yards away, and I'm just trying to get the lay of the land because it's the first time I ever been to that spot. And all of a sudden I heard a twig snap down below, and I look, and here's a cow feeding. She's 25 yards or so from me. And, so, you know, I just kind of backed off a little bit and was listening to the bull up there, and he was just doing what he does, and those cows are real close. And so I decided, okay, I gave him a cow call. Actually, I gave a couple cow calls, and I wanted to blend in with the herd. And to me, that's an important thing when it comes to, because, you know, the cows are the ones that usually blow the whole deal most of the time anyway. So right. To me, if you can learn to cow call good enough to blend in, and when you fool the cows, you know that your chances of success are going to be a lot higher. So mm-hmm. I made a couple cow calls and they never moved. They just kept feeding and none of them looked up or anything like that. And that bull, boy, he let a bugle out. So this time I gave him what I call just like a wannabe bull call. And it was just a little tiny squeal, but I purposely made it sound like a spike. And I know you've heard spikes before call, and they kind of mess up. Mm-hmm. They're going through puberty and all that good stuff. So that's kind of the way I made it sound like. And I tell you what, he not only came back with a full bugle, full grunts. I mean, as tough as he could be, just as soon as that one ended, he did it again. Another bugle, you know, another grunts and the whole bit. So I knew I got his number right then. And what I realized is, okay, he's about 80 yards away from his cows. I'm 25, and he don't like that at all. So
nope.
I gave him another little bugle, and then he started raking, and he gave me another bugle, and I did a little rake. And then here's where I realized, and this is the first time I ever tried it, and I've used it many times since then, is I glunked. And I know there's probably a lot of people that know what glunking is or may have heard it. But for those of you that don't, it is a sound that they make. It's a dominant type sound. And you hear it when they're walking up to their cows and kind of checking them. And I've also heard if any of you that have witnessed a fight, you can hear them glunking just as they're fighting. They're just getting after it. So it's a dominating type call. And I feel what I'm thinking that bull was probably thinking was he heard glunking. That means I'm right there on his cows, because, you know, a lot of time when they're walking up to their hind end there, they're going to glunk just to kind of, here again, show dominance. And I'm sure that's what he's picturing. And he just come uh-huh. running right down, I mean, just charging as fast as he could right to me. And he came out, he walked up to 11 yards, and I shot him. And then nice. He ran down there about 15 yards, and I cow called again as soon as I shot. And I was shooting a recurve at the time. And anyway, he just stood there looking at all of his cows, you know, running off. And then he tipped over. And it was – so I learned a lot on that hunt. I learned a lot. And I think that might have been the year after or the year before, because this bull was a 5-point with, like, little devil's points. So I think that was a year before I decided to – now that I remember – the year I decided to kind of hold out for a bigger bull, but I did learn a lot right there just on that little hunt. Is that you know, they don't want to fight if they can help it, but it really kind of stuck in my mind then. And that glunking is very effective. And so since then, I'll glunk when I feel the opportunity is right or the situation is right.
Right.
But the bull, you know, if I can say anything, a lot of times too is I'll sit if I'm in on a herd, is just try to feel the bull out and see what he is responding to and what he's not. And reading the animals, you know, I can never stress that enough, is just watch an elk, you know, and I think that one year, like I was telling you about when I learned so much was I just got to watch elk be elk. And, you know, you learn a lot just by watching them and not always necessarily charging right in. There'll be times where in one particular spot that I hunt pretty frequently, we have a rock called a Ponches Rock. We go sit up there and you can see for miles around and there's pockets of timber around and I'll watch elk and I'll kind of see, depending on if there's pressure up there with other people or, you know, I'll watch the elk and kind of see what their patterns are. And through the years, you learn a lot of, you know, from what happens when they get pressured, which way, what's their escape route and whatnot. You know, that all kind of comes into play too. Getting in on them though, as far as calling goes, there again, I'll call the least amount that I have to get in on the elk. I don't want them to know I'm even there if I can help it. And
right. I like that.
Duet.
I said, I like to do that as well.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, my first bull and my first three cows, I don't even think I had a call on me.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Well, that's not true. I had a diaphragm, but I would only use it for mews and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost never, ever used it. I was, you know, for a long time, I would maybe use a bugle just to get a location and then head that direction. And it's really just been in the last like 5+ years that really got into the whole calling, mm-hmm. got serious about calling,
yeah.
I should say.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of situations where, I mean, you definitely need it. I know heavily timbered areas, you have to rely on calling a little more than a little bit than open areas. And,
yeah.
You know, I just try not to give myself away if I can help it, cause any type of attention or create any type of attention to myself if I can help it. I did have a situation in New Mexico one time when I was guiding and there was a big bull in there and my client ended up killing him. But there was like 4 satellite bulls and they were just, it was just a screaming match. And I mean, some of these that bull was ended up being in 370s, but the other bulls, I mean, you know, there was 330 satellite bulls and, you know, in a little bit smaller than that. So they're what we would call a really respectable bull in most over the counter states, you know, these are satellite bulls there. But
yeah.
So my first thing there was I wanted to blend in again. So I started off with some bugles because they were all bugling. So it wasn't like I was just all of a sudden quiet and I started the bugling. Those bulls were already bugling. I went in there and I just tried to kind of blend in. And I let him run all those other bulls off because that's what he was doing. He was running all those other bulls off. And finally, we were the last one for him to run off. And when he did run off, it was him that ran off and he ran off with an arrow in him. There was nothing that was going to keep him from, you know, protecting her. And that was, unfortunately for him, his fatal mistake. But sometimes you get those situations, you know, where you can do that. But more times than not, there's so many people out there calling. And I think that's probably why I lean towards being quiet is because they get call shy, you know.
Yeah.
There's been some of those really super easy handheld type cow calls that came out in the past. And I mean, those elk, just like the first outfitter I ever worked for, I remember going in there and And I was with Wayne Carlton Calls at the time. This is before he'd sold out to Hunter Specialties. And so this is back in the 80s or 90s, I should say, late 90s. And this outfitter I worked for, he had been using the same call for 7 years, he told me. And, wow. And so I took in that fighting cow call, which is like the green weenie that Native by Carlton has now, that same type of call. So I went in there with that one there, and I brought one for the outfitter himself and his other two guides. So we all had those. And that outfitter told me, he goes, well, you know, how come they're not coming into me? And I knew it right then. You know, I said, and I told him, I says, well, you've been using that same call for 7 years. I mean, it's just like your voice, John, and probably my voice. After you hear each other a few times, you know the different voices. And and so those elk have been burnt so many times, and they were, everybody was using that same type of bugle. And not that it wasn't a good call, but they get burnt after year after year. And those calves growing up, you know, as they become mature bulls, they learn the same thing. And so they're just onto it. But that year, by changing calls like we did, was one of his highest success archery years he had. His brother, I remember, came up to me and says, I left my grunt tube in camp. He says, he goes, I've been guiding at that point. He says, I've been guiding 16 years. I've never called so many bulls in as I did this year. And, and it was all because it was something new, I guess. And they weren't burnt on it, so to speak. So that's one thing I like about a diaphragm call for people that can, you know, the other handheld ones, they do work good. They make some great noises, but you can variate your, the variations on a diaphragm call, you can control that so much more that, you know, I'm a fan, and as well as it's hands-free. And
I agree.
I hunt a lot by myself. I do have a hunting partner, but I've killed a lot of elk, the majority of my elk, solo. And so, and that did a lot of times did require me calling them in. And I was able to do it. It's just a matter of throwing your calls the right way. And, you know, that's probably the biggest thing, throwing the calls the right way. And I have had them hang up before out there, you know, 80, 90 yards, which you hear those scenarios. And you just got to soften your cow calls up a lot of times and still throw them behind you so they sound like they're farther away instead of being right there in their face. And or call them in your tube, you know, and throwing it back. Those little things do help as well. But changing up your calls. I mean, you know, I can't, there a lot of elk hunters and I do some of these shows and stuff and even seminars, they, you know, they're asking about the different types of calls. And if you, I know it takes a while for some people. It took me a while to learn how to use a diaphragm. But man, once I did, it's, you know, just practice and practice. And there's some, I know you, I think you've had Michael Batiste on your podcast in the past. And for the beginner, pardon me.
Yeah. Just recently had him on a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah. And so for the beginner, you know, for the person that wants to, I know he does some good hands-on type or, you know, video where you can do it on video and he can help you how to adjust that call and that type of thing where, you know, I mean, back in the day, I mean, I had to just throw it in there and try not to choke on it. But once I got a little noise, it kind of came pretty easy then. It was just that initial noise, you know, something. Because, I mean, back then we didn't have, like I said, we're talking the 80s. I know it's a lot older than a lot of people that listen to your podcast. But back then, and I'm kind of glad, you know, I learned how I did because it really makes me appreciate it now. Appreciate, you know, when I did learn back then, you know, how I learned, kind of trial and error. It's a lot simpler. There's a lot more things out there to help now. But, you know, back then we hardly had even, there wasn't, you know, anything on the internet or hell, there probably even wasn't internet. I don't know. But just somebody to obtain any type of elk hunting video was like a big thing. And, you know, a bunch of us guys would get together and go watch it and try to learn something out of it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I noticed that what you were mentioning about them getting used to calls. I remember when that Hoochie Mama first came out, from
that was
Primo.
kind of the call I was referring to, the handheld one earlier. Yeah.
God, but when it first came out, people were slaying the crap out of animals with that thing. And now, if you blow on that, or if you use that thing, they like literally run in the opposite direction.
So my experience one time, I was with a buddy that had one, and I remember he squeezed it, right? And this has been, they had been out for probably a few years at that time. And so he squeezed it, and I looked over. I didn't realize he had one, you know. And he squeezed it, and I was watching this cow. And she looked up, and then he squeezed it again. And she looked our way, kind of like she was trying to figure out where it was coming from for sure. About a minute later, he squeezed, and she never looked away from us. She was locked in our direction. And the third time he squeezed it, she just turned and ran the other way. And, you know, just like you said, yeah, they had great success. Same things. So back, I remember here again, back years ago, do you remember those, the ELK, the little plastic ones with a rubber band that you bit down on? I mean, I remember when those came out, that was the shit, man, back then. I mean, that was pretty good. And it's funny how, now looking back, I don't know how many years you've been hunting elk, but looking back through the years, seeing all the different types of calls that came out. And just like you said, like you were talking about, you know, them learning a new language, a new sound, and in how effective they are or can be if used properly.
Yep. Yeah. I've been hunting elk for about 25 years now.
Oh, nice.
And like I said, my first few years of hunting elk were rifle hunts, and we didn't even use calls. I was introduced to elk hunting from my Uncle Joe, and I mean the tactic back then was drive roads, look for elk, and spot elk from the truck, and then make a move on them and shoot them.
Where was that?
In Arizona.
Arizona, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then when I, you know, started bow hunting them on my own, probably my mid-20s, that's when I started using some calls and stuff, but I said it was really, really minimal. I'm 43 now. I think I got kind of more serious about calling. I must've been about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I was like 33. So, yeah.
I did grow up in a hunting family, but no one bow hunted. So a lot of that, you know, I had to learn.
I was the pioneer for bow hunting. I got everybody in my family that bow hunts.
Yeah.
They bow hunt because of me.
Oh, you got them started. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they see stuff start packing in the freezer and they're like, what are you doing?
Yep.
So yep.
I got it into bow hunting.
I do have to say one thing. One time I remember a year where maybe it was cockiness or whatever, but I mean, you know, I was kind of on a roll killing. I'd probably kill, I don't know, maybe 6-7 bulls in a row. And so this one year I decided. You there? Okay.
Start over on the story because I didn't hear any of it.
Okay. That's right. Yeah. So I just remember a year where, you know, I was probably maybe 6 or 7 years, something like that, killing a bull, you know, every year, my bow and other animals too. But my neighbor asked me about some elk meat. So I thought, you know, I'm just getting given the rest of the elk I have because surely I'm going to kill a bull this year, you know. Well, guess what? My tag is what went in the freezer that year. So note to self, after that, I never did that again. You know, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Yeah, no, that's
stupidity.
Well, you get on a roll, you start, you know, feeling like you got it figured out.
And then, yeah, but you don't. You don't. That's what I love about it, though. You know, every year is kind of a new. Like this last year, I hunted new terrain, you know, a new area and everything. And so it's pretty cool and learn some different, a little bit, the way those elk acted a little bit different, you know, than just because a lot of it was the terrain it was a great year for me to have, like I was saying with my knee, to have a terrain that was easy to moderate terrain. I don't think I could have did a really heavy backcountry hunt like I normally do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, awesome, man. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing a bunch of stories with us and some good information. Where can listeners find out more about you?
Well, let's see, on Facebook, it's Daryl Ponch Nunez, and Instagram is nunez.ponch.daryl. You know, I mentioned to you a little bit about the plan is to, for me and my hunting buddy, to start a podcast, which is certainly going to have you on there as well. And and we're hoping to get it launched here in the next few months. Like I said, I'm getting this new career kind of on the start. And then once that gets going, then we'll do that. Anybody wants to reach out, if I can ever help with anything, be sure and do that. And I just want to thank you for allowing me to come on here, John. And hopefully we run into each other again in Arizona, if not, plan a hunt someday. Yeah. Maybe you and I and Perry can get together and do a hunt sometime. That'd be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Especially after listening to your blacktail hunt thing. That would be a I love blacktail hunting. It's been a few years since I did it, but that'd be a fun hunt sometime too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, me and Charles and I have a lot of fun together.
It sounds like it.
There's always something, and they take great pride in making me remember that I've never killed a blacktail, and love breaking my chops about it. So,
well, you know, it's camp, like anything else. Hang in there.
Camp is always fun. So,
yeah, you hunt hogs quite a bit then too. Then
I used to. I haven't actually gone on a hog hunt. I mean, I javelina hunt all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Javelina hunting is probably, it's one of my most booked hunts. We are literally booked out every season from opening day of archery to the last day of rifle. Every 3 days, you know, we got one. Last year I guided, me personally, 5 different clients for javelina, but between me and my guys, I think we took 24 people out.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, and almost 100% success. I had one guy, and he came out with his dad, him and his dad. It was a 2-on-1. I had both of them, and it had just snowed here in Arizona, in southern Arizona, and it was the first time I've ever hunted javelina in the snow. So he lost a day and a half of hunting, and we still managed to get one, and he still had a shot. He took 2 shots, actually, at some javelina, and it was just, it was kind of thick. It wasn't the greatest situation for him. That was a rifle hunt. Okay. But it's funny, because if it was a bow hunt, I think we would have got him. It's funny because rifle hunting javelina, you either got to get into bow range to kill him, mm-hmm. or you have to kill them far away. Because they're so low to the ground, you have to have the right angle to see them.
Right. Yeah.
So you're shooting across the canyon, or you're shooting down into something. You have to get close, like you're going to kill him with a bow, or you got to shoot him from far away. There's like no in between. So you don't usually get those like 100-yard shots, because when you get to 100 yards, you can't see him.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
You don't get to see him feel like in that 50-yard range. Right? And, you know, and then you have to back up to like the 300-400-yard range to shoot, you know, to see him.
Yeah.
To shoot
him.
A lot of the terrain. There's, yeah, obviously, exceptions to every rule, but.
They are fun to hunt. That's for sure. Anything's fun to hunt. You know, in fact, I went out hog hunting last night, and I'm going to go back out this evening. We got a friend of mine's got some property where they're literally having some problems with them. And, you know, these are feral type hogs here, but, they're blast. I do like hunting them. Good eating too. So, same thing with javelina. I know a lot of people aren't a big fan of eating them, or they say there's not that great. I think they're great myself. I mean, I cook them right.
Yeah, if you know how to cook them, they're actually very good.
Great green chili enchiladas. That's what I do with mine a lot of times.
I haven't tried it, green chili, but I've done some stews. I've done some, like barbecue type stuff, and I've definitely done, you know, like carnitas and stuff like that out of them. But
yeah, I usually just get mine, put them in a crock pot, put some like a pork broth type thing in there, and cook it up so the meat just shreds up. And same thing with turkey legs. A lot of people don't like wild turkey legs because they are tough. I'll do the same thing with those, is just cook them in the crock pot until the meat falls off the bone, and shred it up and make enchiladas out of them. And they're, it's good stuff, man.
Nice. So, we'll talk to you soon.
All right, brother. Take care. Bye.
Hey, guys. Want to stay connected with the podcast? Check out my blog, johnstallone.me. That's www.johnstallone.me. And you could go on there. On the top right-hand corner, there's a little subscribe box. Quickly put in an email address, hit subscribe, and boom, you're done. There's a lot of great information on there. A lot of posts that go hand-in-hand with the podcast that we do, plus gear reviews. Plus we have the signature t-shirts on there, the I Eat Fast Food t-shirts, and the Tuesday Coosday shirts. It's a really good way to stay connected with the podcast. And thanks for listening.